I'm Andrew O'Hagan, host of a new podcast from the London Review of Books. It's about the bloodiest and most controversial event of the Falklands War, the sinking of the General Belgrano. Margaret Thatcher was accused of a war crime. The truth would only emerge in the pages of a private diary. This is the Belgrano Diary. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Welcome to the London Review Bookshop podcast. To find out about our upcoming events, visit londonreviewbookshop.co.uk/events.
Hello, listeners. Since you can't come to the London Review Bookshop at the moment to enjoy our events, we're bringing them to you at home. While we're closed, our new podcast episodes will feature guests who you might, under better circumstances, have been listening to live in Bury Place, as well as previously unreleased gems from our archives.
Right, my name's Anne Pettifor, and I'm really honoured to be here with Nancy Fraser this afternoon to promote her book, and her book is here, with Rahel Yeagi. It's a wonderful book, and I know you're all here, and we're both of us saying how wonderful it is that so many people on a Friday, hot, sunny Friday evening, have come to listen to a discussion effectively about capitalism. And we're just really proud to see you all here and to see so many young people here too.
Yeah.
So I want to begin by asking Nancy to tell us why you and Rahel felt that you had to write a book that was a conversation. And just tell us a little bit about what the motivation was behind the book and what got you to write it.
Great. It is the format is quite unusual. It truly is a dialogue, and if you open the book, you will see in bold letters Fraser blah 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 Yeagi blah 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 blah, and it goes back and forth in this way. Maybe we were channeling Plato. I don't know, but like many books, it was sort of serendipitous that we chose this format. I mean, one person who bears a lot of responsibility is John Thompson, sitting right there from Polity Press, who has a series called Conversations. And at a certain point, John approached me and said, let's do one of these things on you, and let's find a conversation partner. And I thought of Rahel immediately, but I said, I don't want to do it on me. I want to do it as a conversation with two equals about a problem that we are both passionately interested in. Well, what other problem besides capitalism today could fit that bill? And then Rahel is the perfect dialogue partner for me, and I think the results bear it out because we both come out of a certain philosophical tradition of critical theory, and we can say more about that later. And so we share a lot of common reference points, starting with Marx, of course, and then with a whole set of later Marxists and revisers of Marx and critics of Marx. But we don't have exactly the same approach. We share enough to know where the other's weak points are, and we're not afraid to push them, so to speak. So it's actually a very probing conversation between two friends, and I kind of feel it's, you know, the most most exciting thing I've done, actually.
And did it give you the chance to say things and explore things in a way that you wouldn't have done if you were writing a book, you know, beginning to end and thinking the beginning, the middle, and the end? Because it takes you off in different directions.
Absolutely. There's nothing like a partner, an interlocutor, to say, but.
Yeah.
And then you have to answer.
Yeah, yeah.
And that's how the best thinking happens, when you're really forced to get outside of your own head and see it from somebody else's point of view. So I was pushed in to go more deeply into certain kinds of questions that are a little more in the background for me normally. And I think the same was true for Rahel. So the sum, the whole is more than the sum of the two parts, definitely.
So, Nancy, I want you to help me. I'm not an academic, and I know very little about critical theory. And I got to this bit where Yeagi says, could one say that from both sides, liberal Kantian normativism and the post-structuralist critique of normativity, we now find a situation in which the unity of the analysis and critique has fallen apart?
Yeah.
And I had some difficulty understanding that.
I see why.
So the question I want to put to you is, can you tell us something about critical theory and the evolution of it? Because I gather from the book that you're arguing with other critical theorists and also with the way in which the field has evolved. So I want you to tell us something about that, especially for me as someone who is so out of that world.
Absolutely, and I just want to say to the audience that I don't think that sentence is representative.
No, it isn't.
So
you're
don't
right.
Don't get scared off. No, look, there's a narrow sense and a broad sense of critical theory. The narrow sense is the Frankfurt School for Social Research, which developed in the late 20s and 1930s in Germany, was, you know, destroyed in a sense or forced to emigrate due to fascism, and it tried to reconstitute itself in Germany again after the Second World War. And the names that you would know are Herbert Marcuse, Theodor Adorno, Max Horkheimer, Friedrich Pollack, more recently Jürgen Habermas would have been considered the representative figure. But there's also a current generation that includes Axel Honneth, with whom I co-authored a previous book, Shayla Ben-Habib, Rainer Force, and many still younger people, including Rahel Yeagi, would be considered a absolute stellar leading light today. This is a tradition that was founded around the idea of interdisciplinary social research. And I have to say that phrase was sometimes a kind of esoteric, a key word for not saying Marxism.
Yeah.
Interdisciplinary social research. They didn't want to always call themselves Marxists. But it was a so-called Western Marxism, as they called it, meaning anti-Stalinist, anti-Soviet. And they had a great interest in political economy, in culture, in the psychology of the family and authoritarianism. It was quite a really interesting group of rather brilliant people who tried to do something to develop a broader form of Marxism, to analyze the society of their time, which they called state capitalism.
Right.
So fast forward now to, let's say the 1980s, 90s, the 2000s. Then you have a whole influx of a new generation of new leftists, of which I am one, 68ers, who were formed, in a time tremendous ferment and interest in Marxism, again, not a Soviet kind of Marxism, looking to integrate culture, psychology, and so on. But then you have this sort of unfolding that I think we're still struggling with today, of the sort of waning of those energies, that radical spirit, and the sort of slow creeping colonization by liberalism. And the reference that you read to Kantian liberal normative theory is the form that that creeping liberalism took in the world of critical theory. And I have to say, as much as I admire him, the late thought of Jürgen Habermas was the sort of entry point for this.
Yeah, yeah, definitely.
So basically, what you got, what you have had, I think things are changing now, but what you have had is a world, a sort of intellectual circle that pays certain lip service to the idea, the ideals of Frankfurt School, interdisciplinary, quasi-Marxian, or, you know, since inquiry, that is actually more and more doing what I call freestanding moral and political and legal philosophy, as if you could talk about morality, politics, and law without talking about capitalism, without talking about the economy, without talking about the institutional structure of society, about the mechanisms through which relations of domination are entrenched. Yeah. So we're up here like Kant. What ought to be? What does a good society look like? What is a just world? And so on and so forth. And that's the sort of frustration that the passage you read, which, however stylistically awkward, is actually trying to say something important. And it's trying to say that it's one side of the story is this creeping liberalism.
Yeah.
The other side is the post, the other reference was to post-structuralist anti-normativism. And this is a reference to a French version of critical theory. So it's Foucault, it's Derrida, it's Lyotard, it's in a certain way Jacques Lacan. It's a group of people who are also very brilliant and extremely interesting thinkers, but who got the idea that you know, that sort of the normative perspective, the moral critique of society, was essentially useless. Mm. And so here you have two equal and opposite ideas. One is that morality is everything and can be done from on high, and the other is that it's some kind of a ruse. What is left out of this picture? Can I tell you in two words? Left Hegelianism, which is the idea that the people's moral indignation about living in the kind of world we live in actually comes out of a historically situated experience, and when developed, can actually point beyond it to a better world. That's a third position in between anti-normativism and liberal freestanding.
Right.
Okay. And that's what I like very much about this conversation, because I would, of course, as an economist, is that there's so much of what I read on the left which has left out the economy, which has left out, and we'll come to the finance sector in a minute. But the finance sector is the thing for which they have the biggest blind spot. But it's as if the economy doesn't exist, and people go about things outside of the economy somehow. Yeah. And that happens with history, it seems to me. I read history books which are written as if there is nothing, there is no economy at the time when that history is, of which that history is being written. So I like very much that you began to explore that with Rahel. Mm-hmm. And tell us a bit more about where you think that takes us. I mean, do we think that critical theory today is including the economy? And it seems to me it's also part of a wider political thing where liberalism and ultimately the thing that I will call globalization managed to talk about globalization as if, again, there wasn't financialization, and there wasn't an economic. It was about traveling abroad. It was about networking. It was about the internet. It was about all of those wonderful things, but it wasn't about the financialization of the economy. So, could you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, Nancy? I want to approach that question from two different sides, because I think you're absolutely right that there has been a period of sort of social amnesia, or the repression of the critique of political economy.
Repression is the word.
Within critical theory, for sure. Mm. I mean, I can't tell you the puzzled, weird looks I got when I started talking about capitalism. And people said, oh, she's become some kind of a vulgar blah, blah, blah. You know, you can't, as if you can't talk about capitalism except in a vulgar way. So in intellectual circles, yes. And again, liberalism, post-structuralism, that was a 1-2 punch that eviscerated the critique of political economy.
Yeah.
Right? They shared that. But also, one should talk really about the period in which the new social movements unfolded in the real world, as we call it, what I used to call the increasing focus on the politics of recognition, yes, and ignoring what was sort of going on beneath the surface, which was exactly the neoliberalization and financialization of the economy, mm-hmm, in a way that really destroyed the whole presumed social democratic basis from which social movements thought they could go on to further democratization. Big surprise when we, you know, see where that has gotten us. So that's one side of the picture. Social amnesia of the critique of political economy. Hmm. Now the other side is something else. And what I mean by the other side is that those stalwarts who continued to do the critique of political economy did it in an economistic way.
Yeah.
And in other words, they really tended to reduce capitalism to the narrow idea of an economic system. The most important claim and argument in this book, and it comes in different ways from each of us, is that capitalism is not an economy. It is something much bigger. Think of it as something that would be as big as, say, feudalism. It's not about one sector of society. It's about how all the different sectors fit together. And that means that if you want to talk about capitalism, you can't talk about production without talking about social reproduction, something feminists have known for many decades. You can't talk about economy without talking about the political order that shapes and channels and supports the economy. Mm-hmm. You can't talk about any of these things without talking about nature, about the socio-ecological economic relations. Mm-hmm. So what we're doing here is trying to, break up the association that capitalism is simply an economy in the narrow sense. But that has nothing to do with the idea that we stop talking about the economy. It's that we talk about it differently in its relations with these other areas of society.
Yeah. Now, I think that's really important, and I was very pleased to see that in here. So when we were discussing beforehand, Nancy, we talked about the fact that, well, I have a problem with the term capitalism, because I believe that what's happened to capitalism is it's evolved into another thing. Mm. And I'm a little bit one-dimensional about it because I like the fact that you're saying, yes, it's about the whole thing is now, in my view, financialized.
Right.
So we now have a financialized capitalism, right, which no longer bothers with the business of production, which is not bothered to invest or to employ labor or to produce products. Mm-hmm. That's yesterday's story, in my view. Today, all that capitalists want to do is to use existing capital and new finance created by central banks or by other means with which to extract assets from the earth, mm-hmm, from labor, and from the economy. So we now live in what I think of as a financialized and extractive capitalism, right, which is so different. And for me, the difference is this. The old-fashioned capitalist would invest, hire labor, produce, and make a profit. And profits were volatile and would go up and down. Mm. Nowadays, the idea of dirtying one's hands by investing, employing, and so on is anathema. And instead, capitalists want to make capital gains effortlessly, mm, from renting. And so we live in a rentier economy. And I think what's so profound about what you're saying is that it's not just a class that's engaged in this rentier economy. We all are, you know. Mm-hmm. We rent our music. We rent our software. We rent our taxi rides. You know, we rent out our homes. Mm-hmm. And they rent out everything else. And so, you know, we're in a rentier economy. Right. But it's embracing the whole of civilization. It's not just one class. So I would like you to come back, because you've called the book capitalism.
Yes, yes, yes. Well, I certainly want to defend that term. And so I would suggest that we actually, in fact, one of the chapters of the book is called Historicizing Capitalism.
Right.
The book has four main chapters: conceptualizing capitalism, historicizing capitalism, criticizing capitalism, and contesting capitalism. Historicizing is very important because you're right. What capitalism is not something that's just somehow given once and for all, and that's it. It actually undergoes some pretty incredible transformations. I don't want to personify it, but it's, you're tempted to say things like, it's very wily, it keeps reinventing itself, and so on. And in response to what? In response to its own dysfunctionalities and crises.
Yeah.
I would say that the history of capitalism is the unfolding of a series of different forms of capitalism, or different regimes of capitalism, each one of which finds, at least for a period, a way of provisionally stabilizing some of its inherent contradictions and tendencies to generate trouble. And at a certain point, the stabilizations don't hold anymore. The thing unravels. There's a period of crisis. All sorts of interesting things happen politically, not necessarily all good by any means. And competing, right, projects, competing forces with competing agendas fight it out in order to see kind of what is the successor form going to look like. So I think we could talk about the transition from mercantile capitalism in the 16th, 17th, 18th century to a kind of 19th century industrial capitalism, to a state-managed or social democratic capitalism, and then finally to the capitalism you've described, which I would absolutely call, and we do call, financialized capitalism. Mm. So that's one thing. But I want to also make a second point, and that is that I'm not in full agreement with your description of financialized capitalism. I would say it's not that production has disappeared, but the geography of financialized capitalism is very different from the geography of those previous capitalism. A huge amount of manufacturing is now located in the global south, in the so-called BRICS. Those parts of the world used to be, let's say, the hunting grounds for exactly the sort of extractivism and expropriation that you're describing. They were just places to be looted.
Yeah.
For dependent coerced labor, for land, for mineral wealth, for you name it. So the form that capitalism took there was not premised so much on the exploitation of free labor power as on the expropriation of unfree and dependent populations who lacked a state to protect them. Mm. Okay, we're talking, after all, about colonialism and so on. And even post-colonial forms of neo-imperial extraction. Okay, today what I would describe financialized capitalism today as sort of scrambling what used to be a sharper distinction between exploitation and expropriation. It used to be that expropriation was over there, and that was something that you did to people of color, basically.
Right.
Exploitation of the free worker who receives the socially necessary costs of his and maybe even his family's own reproduction, that's whites, those are Europeans, that's over here. Well, these two worlds are completely scrambled now.
Yeah.
There's plenty of exploitation over there, and there's plenty of expropriation over here.
Yeah.
And even the the color line that used to divide these things is mixed up.
Right.
As workers in the global north, supposedly free workers, are often not paid the full socially necessary costs of their reproduction. They are forced to go into debt in order to meet their present day living costs.
Yeah.
So we have student debt, we have payday loans, we have credit cards, we have mortgage and microcredit. I mean, all of this proliferation of just even consumer debt without even talking about sovereign debt.
Yeah.
And that's part of the scrambling. You can be exploited and expropriated at the same time.
Yeah.
And almost most of us actually are. That strikes me as historically new. It's not that production disappears, but it's done by others. And
but Nancy, I would like to argue that it's a small part of the total of the capital gains made by today's capitalists. Uh-huh. But I may be wrong, because to be honest, I haven't added it all up. But when I look at BlackRock, for example, which has $6 trillion under asset management and operates beyond the reach of any government or state, any regulatory body, and operates out there in the stratosphere, but very much with the help of the global central banks, you know, they don't anywhere, I mean, and go near, they soak up and they suck up the savings and the surpluses of all those engaged in productive activity.
Right.
But they go, you know, so, and make huge gains, unlike, you know, well beyond the gains that can be made from production. So
I think that's right. I mean, again, we would want to see the numbers here, and I don't have them. But it's certainly my impression. I mean, I would say that there are lots of things that distinguish different phases of capitalism. But one thing is exactly what is the relation between exploitation and expropriation. I spoke about the geographical relation, but we could also talk about what are the quantities, right? Where is the, you know, which is serving which, so to speak.
Yeah.
And I mean, I think you could say that for mercantile capitalism, the profit streams that came from direct exploitation of labor in commodity production were pretty small compared to the streams that came out of just looting and enslaving people on, right?
Yeah. So the ratios were pretty much the same.
But certainly in social democratic capitalism, the part of the problem is if we're so used to looking only at the first world or what we could now call the global north, instead of seeing this as a world system, once you take the global perspective, which is not the same as globalization in the sense but once you take a global perspective, I think you are struck by how much of capitalism has not depended on employing free labor in commodity production, how much of it has relied. And then let's also talk about the unwaged work of women and social reproduction, which is another part of this business. I would say that, again, I don't know, capitalism as a form of social life. No, let me start over. Let's talk not about capitalism. Let's talk about capital. Capital as what Marx famously called a machine for self-expanding value.
Yes.
Capital is always aimed at self-maximization, and which means a constant impulse to free ride on inputs that you don't have to pay for or that you don't have to pay the full replacement costs of.
Yeah.
And that's nature. That's what the ecological crisis is all about. That's social reproduction and what the so-called crisis of care is all about. And that's, the sort of free riding on public goods and public infrastructure
and
the hollowing out of the state
by
financialized capitalism.
Look, we said that we were going to allow the audience loads of time to ask questions.
And we haven't.
But no, we haven't. And now I want to ask you just one more thing before we do allow them.
Okay.
I want to ask you about the left and the left's collusion with the development of this new capitalism.
Yeah.
Because that is a huge problem that we face here. Social democracy has collapsed across Europe.
Yeah.
And it has collapsed, in my view, because of its collusion with the neoliberal globalization project. And here we're in a struggle against the Blairites of the Labour Party, who similarly colluded in globalization, and don't understand why we have Brexit and why we have Corbyn. But we have Corbyn in a sense as a reaction against that. But I know that you know in the US the Democrats are split, and I'd love to just hear what you think about that before we open it up a bit further.
It's a great question. I just have to quibble with your use of the word the left, because I don't. Social democracy hasn't been left for a very long time, in my opinion. Maybe we differ about that.
No, we don't. You're right. Okay.
Okay. So, I mean, the term that I've given for this collusion might be useful. I know it's useful in the U.S., and I think it's useful here, too. I've called it progressive neoliberalism. And this is a kind of really unholy alliance between just those dynamic sectors of finance, capital, IT, the kind of post-material symbolic part of the economy that is cosmopolitan, that is interested in globalization and so on, in an alliance with what I think of as the liberal mainstream currents of progressive social movements, lean-in feminism, meritocratic anti-racism, green capitalism, multiculturalism, et cetera, et cetera. And I think that's what Blairism was here, and I think that's what Clintonism, and then continued by Barack Obama, has been in the United States. And we could talk about François Hollande, and on and on and on. I was even in India recently, and the late days of the Congress Party are exactly that as well. So that's been the sort of hegemonic historic bloc, in Gramsci's sense, that has ruled the world or major parts of it in recent decades. And, you know, it's surprising that it took so long for, you know, there to be the reaction that we're now struggling to understand and to figure out how to intervene in Brexit, in Trump, and so on, the strong showing of all these racist anti-immigrant parties throughout Northern and East Central Europe. So I think this is a complicated thing. It's a response, on the one hand, to the hollowing out of living standards by the 30 years of neoliberalization and financialization that you're talking about. But it's also a rejection of the apparently progressive ideas, the cosmopolitan ethos, the sense of meritocratic superiority, and so on, that has been somehow fused with this political economy by this unholy progressive neoliberal alliance. And if you sort of turn both of those things on their heads and you say, I'm against the neoliberalism and I'm against the progressivism, what do you get? Reactionary populism. It's the exact inverse of that. And so we could go on and on about Trump and so on. And the left, okay, the left. I don't know, what about, you know, trying to sort of take those, we've got like four things, we've got neoliberalization, we've got some kind of really egalitarian, progressive political economy, we've got reactionary recognition, we've got progressive recognition. Let's try to put together a substantively egalitarian, class-sensitive politics of recognition with an egalitarian political economy, an anti-financialized political economy. That's, to me, that's very formulaic and abstract, but it's
what the left has to do.
That's the only thing that would deserve the name of left, in my opinion.
Right. Great. Wonderful.
A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at UH1.com.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weight loss. That's PlushCare.com/weight loss. PlushCare.com/weight loss.
Please, can you ask questions? I'm going to favour people at the back who've had a hard time listening. And also, can I say that if you could make your question not longer than, say, 3 sentences, but it must end with a question mark. Right. Okay. Anyone? Who's first? 2 women at the back there, please. And then a gentleman at the back, too.
I want to go back to what you were saying about capitalism as something bigger than an economy, something that encapsulates much more than just economic relations. It's something I've thought about quite a lot, and I'm an academic and I'm also an activist, and I've thought a lot about how to crush and overcome this kind of particular form of society or whatever, economy, whatever capitalism is. And I think that there's a lot to gain from that sort of broader analysis. We can see connections between capitalism and other political forms, for example. But I wonder if there's also something that we lose from that kind of analysis. And I wanted to ask you to talk more about that. So, for example...
That's your question, is it?
Yes. So do we lose anything in terms of the possibilities of overcoming capitalism when we perceive it as some kind of overarching system?
Ah, right. I've got you. You got that, Nancy? Can we take 3 questions before you answer?
Okay, but I would...
Do you want to take notes?
Otherwise, I would have to take a note. Let me just...
Okay,
I'll try
fine.
To be very brief.
Fine.
I mean, I don't know about losing, but I think it's becomes harder to overcome capitalism if you think of it in the way I'm talking about. Let's put it this way. If you think it's only an economy, then you might think it's sufficient to socialize the ownership of the means of production. If you think it's about the relation of production and reproduction, then you've got to think about reorganizing that relation as well. If you think it's about, it's also about the relation to nature and about free riding and not paying the replacement costs of the exploitation of nature, then you've got to do something more than socialize the ownership of the media. So it is a bigger set of problems. It's about how to relate different aspects of life, while also, yes, let's socialize the means of production too while we're at it, of course. Yes.
Okay. So there's a second question there. Yeah.
Hi, thanks so much for the talk. It's really interesting.
Can you stand up louder?
Yeah, sorry. So I'll try to make my question brief, but basically it's on the rise of artificial intelligence and what that means for labor, both in terms of product, like manufacturing is already transforming, like robots are doing that and will be doing that. So a lot of people who got those manufacturing jobs in the South are going to be jobless. But also the rise of artificial intelligence to do reproductive labor, like, for example, sex robots. Like sex robots that are already existing.
Sex robots.
And marketed. And, like, if that's, like, sort of, like, you know, an extending arc of exploitation where you're going to produce and exploit robots... I mean, I can see the challenges in that, but what are the opportunities for us to, like, resist this extreme commodification? Because perhaps we'll have more free time? I don't know.
Yeah,
I'm trying to think, what do you see developing in the future?
No, you won't.
Yeah, but I'll say a little bit, but I think you might be able to have it. So, I mean, first of all, this story about the question of automation and taking away jobs is a very old story. Every sort of new technological breakthrough brings exactly this kind of worry. And so far, the system always finds ways of employing people of course, as cheaply as possible and under, you know, with the least labor rights and so on and so forth as they can get away with. So I would want to separate the question of the technology itself from the question of its social organization, who controls it, who profits from it, who decides how to use it and where, and who's going to play what role. These are the important social and political questions. And I would say that the problem with capitalism as a form of social organization, that it completely removes all those questions from the collective self-determination of the people who have to live with the system. Yeah. Yeah. It just hands them off to quote-unquote market forces or et cetera, et cetera. So, I mean, I don't, those are real questions. I mean, I'm not so interested in having sex with a robot, although who knows, maybe. but seriously, I mean, we should be able to decide these things and not have them somehow foisted on us by these anonymous, impersonal forces.
And I just want to add that I think it's delusional, all this talk about technology and robotification of everything, because it assumes the infinite supply of resources of nature's resources for these things. I grew up in a small gold mining town in the Orange Free State in South Africa. And today there is no more gold. It's gone. It's been excavated, it's been taken, extracted, and it's no longer there. And this idea of limits and the finite nature of the rare earths, for example, that drive all our mobile phones, We ourselves enjoy that delusion that actually we can go on having smartphones when actually those rare earths are very scarce. And I think that capitalism just cannot conceive of that finitude, really. And that's where it's a problem. Now, there was a third question at the back.
Hi, thank you. I'm part of a design program grad school.
Sorry, can you speak up?
Oh yeah. So I'm part of a graduate design program, and one of the things that I find missing sometimes is a kind of.
Could you speak into the mic?
So one of the things I find missing in my experience with design programs, being in graduate school, is a kind of understanding of the role that capitalism. Okay, of a kind of you know, one of the roles that capitalism can play in the decisions that designers can make when they join large tech companies. I mean, most of my friends work at Apple, Google, Facebook, Amazon. And one of the things that troubles me, and I'm curious as to the question, is, you know, what might be, in your opinion, more structural roles that designers can play from within these, you know, large corporations that are, you know, rebuilding society?
Yeah. This is a very interesting question because I teach at the New School for Social Research.
I go to Parsons. Yeah.
You're from Parsons?
Yep.
Oh, okay. So I was going to say, and so I have students who are from design.
Sure.
And this question about the political economy of design and the constraints on it, and because a lot of the students, and I assume you're one of them, come with, lots of sort of idealistic ideas about, you know, how they can change city life for the better and so on and so forth. And then, you know, the rubber hits the road and, you know. There are two different levels here. I mean, I hate to be sort of the bearer of bad news, but, you know, when you ask what can designers actually do individually in these organizations, I don't know, maybe not a huge amount. But on the other hand, if they organized, if they became politically active and thought about how to make political alliances with other forces that shared their concerns and values, that
subversive.
Would be a different story. Yeah.
Yeah. Next question. That young woman there. Okay. Yeah.
Yes.
Thank you.
Anne.
Hi, I just had a question about how you talked about how capitalism kind of reproduced.
Speak right in.
I've got a really quiet voice. You talked about how capitalism reproduces itself. It kind of remorphs into different reactions to its kind of, contradictions and everything. Do you think that citizenship has kind of responded and evolved alongside that as a kind of superstructure that reinforces that evolving base? And do you think that it would be fair to see sort of different manifestations of maybe citizenship from becoming a kind of prima facie right, maybe under state capitalism, to being a kind of contractualization, or it's kind of even sacralized, something that's, you know, earned and can be lost, or maybe dependent on certain characteristics like being a productive body. Do you think that you've seen that shift in a kind of specific way? And well, there's another question. I'll leave that for that.
Yeah. So that's a really interesting question, because, I mean, one thing that is extremely important is sort of how the economic, the demonism and dynamism of the economic, you know, power of accumulation is sort of tamed, organized, structured through a political order. And certainly expansion of citizenship to propertyless people, the expansion of rights, as theorized, for example, by T.H. Marshall, from legal and civil rights to political and social rights and so on. I mean, this evolution, and things can also go backwards, as I guess you're suggesting they have now, and I would agree, devolution of citizenship is important in relation to the changes that capitalism as a system undergoes, the relation between its economic dimension and its political dimension. The other thing about citizenship that's so important for us now is there's been, you know, we don't have colonies anymore. Everybody is supposed to have a state and be a citizen of something. But, I mean, look at the vast differences in terms of what that actually conveys in terms of rights and benefits. I mean, if you're talking about, you know, South Sudan or whatever, what are you really talking about? So this question of migration, of refugees, of asylum, the whole question of nationalism and territorial state borders with respect to citizenship at a time when capital, in contrast, is free to go just anywhere at the drop of a hat in a second flat. This is also a big change in the relation between the political and the economic in this financialized capitalism.
Yeah.
So I find your analysis of the crisis of care at the heart of capitalism very compelling, but it makes me wonder immediately what arrangement of social reproduction would be truly left and egalitarian. So my question is, what should the left be pushing for when it comes to social reproduction?
So did everyone hear that question?
Yeah,
did you hear it at the back?
Repeated,
oh, good. Right. It's a great question.
Sounds much better at the back.
Oh, right.
Really?
Oh,
okay.
I see.
Okay. So what should the left be pushing for how to think about social reproduction? So, I mean, it's much easier to say what the limits of certain obvious possibilities are than to say what are the really good ones. Okay. So, you know, one idea is that, men should do it too. That's actually simple, but... You know, it's elegant, simple and elegant, and important. But how? Do you try to sort of keep everything else more or less the way it is and then put moral pressure on them? No, it doesn't work. Believe me, I've tried. So then you have all these schemes, like the Scandinavians were quite advanced in this issue, and all kinds of very generous parental leave and other kinds of primary caregiving needs for caring for aging parents and so on and so forth. And then they saw that it was really women overwhelmingly who were taking them. Then they said, oh, well, we can fix that. Let's have a use it or lose it idea, that if the men don't use it, they lose it, and they put various incentives to get men to take some of those leaves and do it. That actually produced some better results, but still very far from. I mean, one problem is that because of their advantages in the labor market, men tend to earn more, and it from a strictly economic point of view, made more sense for them to keep working and for the women to take the lead. So in other words, what you see is that all these things are completely interconnected, and you can't change reproduction without changing production. You can't change the family without changing the economy and the state. I can't give you a positive answer except revolution. I mean, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, I like for myself, but not everyone is going to agree about this. This all has to be argued out. I really like the idea of a more collective or communal way of dealing with housework, with familial responsibilities. For some people, that really probably isn't so appealing. I think that I'd like to see... I'm not categorically against paying people to do care work, but at the right salary, with the right dignity, with all the labor rights, and so on and so forth.
Yeah.
But I don't want to see it. I'm not either for just like wages for housework as the solution to everything.
Yeah.
So.
Right. Any more questions? A woman here and a woman there, and then you, right? So I puzzle how the others can hear you, but let's go.
Is it working? Okay. I was wondering if you could talk a bit more about why it was the case that kind of critical theory or political philosophy in general moved away from serious critique into sort of Kantian silliness,
right,
or post-structuralist silliness. Or, you know.
Why it was.
Yeah. Why did critical theory move away from the critique of political thought? You know, I think it almost everyone did. So, there might be a special story about critical theory, but this is a bigger, larger phenomenon. And I think you could maybe say that at the outset, many people thought that they were really sort of expanding the realm of social life that could be and should be subject to critique, the family, personal life, sexuality. Of course, these things needed to be talked about. And then you had all this very interesting stuff by people like Foucault about, and the New Left, for example, about how, you know, discipline in social welfare institutions and so on and so forth. I think people thought they were adding something to the critique of political economy. But somehow what was supposed to be an addition ended up as a substitution. I guess historians will have to figure out why at some point. But what I do know is that the timing of this was disastrous, because the substitution happened just as this process of neoliberalization was underway. And you had, you know, lots of people in the Mount Pelerin Society and around James Buchanan. And so, I mean, these people were actually plotting how to do this at the same time that what should have been the left was worrying about whether it was essentialist to use the category women.
Yeah.
Okay. In a nutshell.
So can I say that I think there was a conspiracy as well, in my view. I mean, I think capitalism decided that actually making itself intangible, and maybe it's not as conscious as that, but this intangible stuff, but also secretive. I mean, the Mont Pelerin Society, Buchanan. Hardly anyone here, by the way, knows about Buchanan, you know, and he's buried.
So important. Let's give a plug. Do you know Nancy Nancy McLean's new book?
No.
What's it called? Does anyone know the title?
Is it about Buchanan?
Oh, yeah.
It's
about the Virginia School, about the plot. So I sound like Philip Roth. The plot to destroy democracy.
Well, this is what I think. It was a plot, because I don't think, you know, it wasn't an accident that critical theory or the left all were distracted into these tangible areas of academic and intellectual pursuit, why finance went away in an intangible way and expanded itself and did, you know, and markets became and remote and detached. And it seems to me criminal that we did not, and we still do not see it. I get very frustrated with the left. The left wants to talk about, you know, big bad businesses like Apple and Amazon and all of that, and they are big and they are bad, but actually there are bigger businesses out there which you do not see and which you don't ever encounter, and which actually are dictating governance across the world. I think it was not an accident that happened, but I think it was a weakness on the part of the left, not by the left here, of those radical, not seeing that and not exploring that, and it continues to this day. I think I will go crazy if I hear another Marxist tell me that the crisis was caused by the declining rate of profit. And I've heard that over and over again. And, you know, the fact of the matter is that it's been discussed as if the declining rate of profits of industrial companies caused the global financial crisis. And it's as if they're determined not to see what is going on out there. Anyway, that's my rant on that point.
You're talking about companies like BlackRock and Blackstone.
I am indeed.
Who operate maybe in collusion with government.
On the dark
very
side.
Very close collusion with the state and with central banks, yeah. There was another question there, yes?
Yes, I'm curious what your thoughts are on... I am curious what your thoughts are on universal basic income in the context of capitalism. Yeah. Do you think it's something that might lead to a transformative solution, maybe a challenge to capitalism, or do you think it's something that might encourage the status quo in this respect?
Right. That's an interesting question, and there's been a lot of rather thoughtful debate on both sides. And my view is that everything depends on the context, because in theory, it looks like the sort of thing that Andre Gortz would have called a non-reformist reform, a reform that is saying within capitalism that we guarantee everyone at least well, it depends how minimal, but at least a basic survival, which means you have the ability to withhold your labor power. You're not forced to work. That's supposed to mean that you're empowered vis-a-vis capital to demand better terms and so on and so forth. The problem is that in practice, it has often turned out to be a way of subsidizing low-wage labor, of subsidizing capital. It permits them to pay lower wages because people then get... So I think partly... And also, do you know that the most famous... one of the early and most famous philosophical defenses of UBI was this famous article by Philippe von Parrish, Why Surfers Should Be Fed. That's a great title. However, while the surfers are out being fed, who is cooking for them?
Yeah.
This does absolutely nothing to deal with the gender division of labor. That very image of who the recipient was going to be is quite interesting.
Yeah.
And I think it depends upon... I wouldn't say that UBI could never have some transformative effects, but it really depends on the other, the whole policy framework in which it's embedded. What kinds of labor regulations and minimum wage laws there are, how generous it is, of course, what are the social reproductive, social service supports, and so on and so forth. It really depends, yeah.
So we had one more question, which was yours, and I think it may have to be the last one, David. Is that right? It's 8:05.
Sir.
Yeah? There'll have to be two, because I promised this gentleman here.
This gentleman first.
Yes.
Thanks. So just hopefully a quick one, which is how do you think state governance structures would need to change to accommodate for a kind of sort of capitalism that incorporates ecological and social systems as well, or are they not the right... Is that not the right place to look for that sort of change?
Well, I think the first thing to say is that climate change is a truly global problem. There's no solution in one country, to use a famous phrase. And it involves, by definition, some globally applicable policies, whether we're talking about a carbon tax or, you know, just jailing corporate megalith polluters. You know, there have to be, in the end, some a global governance regime to deal with that. That's one aspect of it. But there also has to be, as I was sort of saying before, you know, a great deal of democratic planning. Planning has gotten a bad word because of, you know, communism. But it's absolutely essential for many things. And I don't think it means that you completely get rid of markets, for example. I mean, they're all, I would defend some version of market socialism with a lot of planning. The key question is democratic planning.
Yeah.
And, you know, we've had some interesting experiences like the, I mean, none of them turned out exactly the way you wanted, but nevertheless, interesting things like participatory budgeting in Brazil. Why not participatory carbon budgeting, participatory planning of, you know, how to relate to nature?
I think we're going to have to stop there. You're going to have an opportunity. Here is the book, and it's for sale here, and there are plenty of copies. Nancy's around to talk to if you want to speak to her directly afterwards. And thank you very much for all participating, and especially thank you to Nancy.
Thank you, Anne.
Thanks for listening. To find out more about London Review Bookshop events, visit londonreviewbookshop.co.uk/events.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.